Welcome to Inside Investing. This is Will Ortel in New York, and on the phone with me is Navneet Munot in Mumbai, and he is at SBI Mutual Funds, and we're talking about India broadly. Navneet, I'm looking at a report from the Reserve Bank of India that says corporate profitability, this is, you know, broad-based corporations in India, is down about 2%. Now, it's still big. It's 1.74 crore rupees. But how does this make you feel about business fundamentals in India? Is it still a rosy picture?
So there is a part of the economy that has got impacted more badly, and there's the investment side of it. So companies into industrial infrastructure, I think those are the ones who got impacted. But if you look at the latest results, I think there's another set of companies that have got benefit from a weaker rupee. So those who are exporters, those who are into information technology, pharmaceuticals, engineering, autos, they've got benefit because of the weaker rupee. Particularly in the financial sector, because given the downturn in the economy, there has been a stress on the asset quality side of the banking system. So financials have been put under pressure. Though the banks or financial services company who cater to the retail market, they seem to be chugging along well, because the overall retail delinquencies have not increased much in this downturn. By and large, I think the corporate profitability is bottoming out. The two things that kept pressure, one was that a lot of people who expanded capacity, extrapolating the 9% growth that we were witnessing till 2008, came for a shock when the growth fell and the global environment turned very negative. So for them, there's a lot of capacity which is yet to come on stream and generate revenues. And also because of the government slow decision making and the political environment has resulted in lots of infrastructure projects which are at the last mile. So for lack of environmental clearance, land acquisition or forest clearance or several ministry bureaucratic clearances, and they have been pending. So that got impacted, and also the pressure on margins, because the raw material prices were up, rentals went through the roof, the labor cost in India was going up in an excess of 15-20%, interest rate cost was going up, currency was weakening, so that they got impacted on margins as well as top line. But from here on, I believe that as the cycle turns, the asset turnover improves, and also the pressure on margin recedes. I see better days ahead for corporate profitability.
I just want to drill on one of those comments, which is that the you mentioned basically companies that have dollar revenues and rupee expenses as being a particular bright point in this environment. Does that signal a return to sort of an offshoring and business process outsourcing based competitive structure for India, or is that just sort of a short term thing?
I think that's quite structural, because, I mean, all said and done, India has got advantage in terms of having large English-speaking, educated talent pool, and the cost pressure have receded for them. While the global environment has turned positive with the growth reviving in U.S. and other parts of the world, these companies have got benefited, and also the rupee depreciation obviously is helping them. But there are other sectors who lost competitiveness between, let's say, 2005 to 2008-09, when our economy was doing very well. The labor cost, and as I previously mentioned, I think the cost structure went up, and the rupee was strong. So they lost competitiveness. But we are seeing a renewed, trust on getting the competitiveness back in several sectors. Autos is a classic example. I mean, some of the two-wheeler companies, the Bajaj Auto, and some others, I think regaining the market share in the world market. Similarly, several companies in auto ancillaries and in engineering particularly is another sector where India has got the advantage of R&D skills and low-cost labor. So I think across sectors, a weak rupee is likely to help the corporate India.
Well, you're talking about the changing international investment climate, and that's something that's fascinated me as I've sort of kept digging into India, and I wonder if you could sort of comment on flows a little bit. I mean, how important and how closely, you're a domestic Indian investor, how closely are you watching international investors in Indian equities and their flows in and out of the market? How material is that to you?
Well, but they've been extraordinarily important because what happens is that foreign institutional investors now almost own 22% or so of the market cap of India. And if you adjust it for the floating stock, because a large part of the market cap is with the promoters, be it the government or the private entrepreneurs or some of the multinational companies, I think they own a substantial chunk of the floating stock. They are a large part of the daily volumes, and I think their flows dictate the market. I mean, to put it simply, I think we dance to the tune of global investors who get in turn driven by the global liquidity and the global risk environment. Why is that? Because we run a large current account deficit, so obviously the country needs huge amount of capital flows. The flows by these foreign investors impact the currency market, they impact liquidity and interest rates here, and they impact the sentiment in the equity market as well. In last couple of years, the domestic savings, India has got a very high household savings rate, but unfortunately, a large part of that saving is not coming into the financial instruments, but going into real assets like real estate and gold. And the domestic investors are becoming very marginal player in the equity market. And that's why the foreign investors, I think their flows make all the difference. So you can do a chart of last 15 or 20 years, every single year, where foreign investors poured in money, the markets did well. And every year where foreign investors were sellers, I think market didn't do well. But I hope that going forward, I think domestic investors will start reallocating their savings into equities, as equities are relatively becoming more attractive compared to the other asset classes, and that equation may change going forward. But as of now, I think foreign investors are a very, very critical variable in the overall direction of equity markets.
I want to pick up on the current account deficit thought in a second, but first I want to go to the comment you had about domestic investors. Now, I mean, what really needs to happen in order to spur that growth in, you know, a domestic shareholder base, basically? Is that something that's just like a kind of a last mile problem, similar to those infrastructure projects, or is that really a big challenge?
I think a variety of things. In the last 20, 25 years, domestic investors, I think just like anywhere else in the world, they came at the peak of the market. They didn't have the good experience with the equities. There were some structural flaws in the system where probably the retail investors didn't make money. Also, India didn't have a very sustained long-term bull market. So we had markets that delivered exceptional return in, let's say, the year 92 or the year 99, 2000, and then 2006-7. But unfortunately, the retail investors came at the peak. They had bad experience, and generally equities still perceived as something which is very speculative. Another structural factor is that we don't have, a 401k type pension plans or the retirement savings infrastructure in place where a good part of savings automatically go into the equity market like U.S. and some of the other parts of the world. I think India needs to get that right. The pension reforms have just begun, and I hope that over a longer period, given the demographics and the high savings rate, people start investing a lot more into equity. And though the infrastructure now is in place, I think in terms of whether it's settlement cycle, in terms of the dematerialization, the overall infrastructure of the stock exchange, corporate governance, the regulation, everything is in place. But somehow, as you mentioned, the last mile, I think people need to be educated and then given the importance of the equity in their overall savings portfolio to get inflation-adjusted returns. I think once that is done, I think a lot of money can come into the market. Another interesting feature is that the two other asset classes where people have put money in last 10, 15 years, real estate and gold, and both of have done phenomenally well, even adjusted for the volatility and the liquidity. And that's why this perception that, you know, it's better to put money in a real asset rather than paper assets. And I think that needs to change. Hopefully, I think it will change over a period of time.
And, you know, I just want to underscore for the audience that investing in gold is not just a 15-year-old trend in India. It seems like to me a 2000 or 10,000 year old trend. Is that there's a sort of cultural focus on doing that may not be very clear to an international base of investors.
Yeah, Yeah, but in the last couple of years, it increased significantly as percentage of our GDP. The gold import just shot through the roof. And for the simple reason, their real interest rates were negative. Mm-hmm. The consumer inflation was running much higher than the policy rates, and that led people into more physical assets. And also something to do with the cycle that in the last decade, at least in the rupee terms, because the rupee depreciated, people made good money in gold. And also another reason that, Indians have got a fascination for gold for 2,000 years. But having said that, in the last 20 years, I think we have built a very good financial market. I mean, we have built good infrastructure in terms of whether it's the banks or, the mutual funds, insurance companies who are reaching out to millions of investors. But still, I think the proportion of savings coming into financial assets has declined, particularly in the last 3-4 years. Which is a bit worrisome for the policymakers and for us.
Yeah, and that gets back to the current account deficit thought. And, I was actually just listening to Mr. Shanmugaratnam from Singapore, the head of the Monetary Authority of Singapore, talk about, and that, it's not, a current account deficit in and of itself is not intrinsically bad. Do you see the lighter side of a current account deficit, or is it the sort of thing that, you and perhaps the market more broadly are viewing as kind of holding India back?
I think as long as it's manageable, as long as it doesn't create extraordinary pressure on the currency market, it doesn't lead to a destabilization in financial markets, it doesn't lead to some kind of instability in the overall macroeconomic environment. And we saw the signs between June and August when Fed announced, or probably Fed announced the intention of tapering, and the massive impact it could have not only on the financial markets in India, but also on the sentiments and the real economy. Mm. So the current account deficit reaches a point where the funding becomes, a day-to-day challenge. That is quite worrisome. But I think a 1-2% of current account deficit for a country like India, which needs to invest more than probably its saving, I think it is largely in order. And if you think from a global perspective, I think few countries have to run the current account deficit. I mean, if everybody runs current account surplus and keeps building reserves, I think that may not be good.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, in places that need investment, that's okay. That's what a current account deficit is. You brought up the word tapering, and I wanted to ask you, just how often do you think about that word? Because here in New York, we think about it quite a bit. But on the other side of the world, it may not be obvious how important it is to you.
So we hear almost the same what people sitting in New York, because ultimately our markets are governed by what people in New York think. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, the foreign investors are extremely critical for us, for the equity markets, for currency, and for recently the bond market as well. So I think tapering, at least in the very near term, makes some impact. But longer term, if you look at last 20 years, every time the U.S. Fed was increasing interest rates, or U.S. Federal Reserve was tightening the policy, it turned out to be good for the Indian markets. The first few days or first few weeks, markets would tend to react negatively because that would mean less liquidity available into the market. But over a longer period, if U.S. economy is doing well, I think that generally augurs well for Indian economy. One is the trade linkages. I think probably whether it's IT export, it's healthcare or some of the other industries. And over a longer period, there is a bit of correlation between the Indian IIP, the Index of Industrial Production, and the U.S. ISM with maybe a 3-6 month lag. So a revival in global growth is generally good for India. But market takes a few weeks to realize that fact, and then the first reaction just in line with every other market in the world, where when Mr. Bernanke or Mrs. Yellen talks about tapering, people perceive it a bit negatively. But my sense is that once the tapering starts, which, eventually it has to, I think if it is driven by a strength in the U.S. economy, I think that should be good for Indian economy and markets.
Does the same linkage apply to other sort of monetary zones? I mean, would you say that you're as concerned with things coming out of the ECB as you might be with things coming out of the Fed?
I think very much. I think, if I remember correctly, it was Jan and Feb 2012 when they announced LTRO, and Indian markets, despite an extremely challenging macro and political environment, markets went up 25%. And for no reason but just that ECB showed, you know, signs of printing a lot of money, and then the LTRO, empty money, came into India. So I think we get a lot more impacted by global liquidity, the global central bank stance, global risk on risk-off sentiments. I think they impact a lot our markets, at least in the very near term. Of course, in the longer term, logically, it's the corporate fundamentals and the economic fundamentals that should drive the market. But in the interim, I think it's the global liquidity that impacts a lot.
Mm. Yeah, and the I want to ask, you know, how do you, is it challenging in that case to sort of search for value among these equities? And if you're in this environment where you've got this essentially, you know, tidal international investor sentiment, I mean, how does that frustrate your hunt for, you know, adequate risk reward for your investors inside of the country?
Yeah, so it actually also creates an opportunity for a domestic investor. So, I mean, somebody who's got a slightly longer-term horizon and he can, rather than getting swayed by the volatility which is induced by the behavior of global investors, I think sometimes it creates good opportunity. So if markets are rising just because the global liquidity environment is improving, I think you can be on the other side of the fence and vice versa. So I think it creates an opportunity for those who can take advantage of the research arbitrage. Another aspect is that in the last 5 years, I think we would have got more than $80 billion from foreign investors, while the domestic investors have continuously been selling in the market. Now, a large part of this money or a bulk of this money has chased around 50 or 60-odd stocks, and it has created a valuation gap between so-called defensive and the cyclical. So some of the stocks that foreigners are chasing, the large mega caps within the consumer, healthcare, IT, and then some of the private sector retail banks, I think the valuations have risen there. While rest of the market, because the domestic investors are not buying, the cyclicals had become a lot more cheaper. And now I'm seeing a trend where the domestic investors are focusing on finding value within those stocks which are neglected by the foreign investors.
Talking about, you know, finding value, I mean, there's the obviously the chase for value through, you know, all the listed equities. But, if you reach into your own wallet, I assume that there are some rupees there. I want to ask, I mean, you know, is the fact that, you know, I would assume as an individual and as an investor, you hold a bunch of rupees. Is that a source of worry, a source of confidence, or sort of both? Or sort of neither, rather. It hasn't been an easy 18 months for you, probably.
Yeah, so basically for Indians, I think gold is a dollar asset somehow. I mean, because I mean, if the domestic economy is not doing well and you've got higher inflation, then through the weaker currency, you get the benefit and then your investments and then in gold. So maybe people don't talk about it, but probably subconsciously, it's the global diversification. Talking about as an individual, you know, your expenses are in rupee and then you're earning in rupee. And then I think in the last couple of years, the income growth has been in line with the nominal GDP growth. So people are that way okay. Investors really chasing and trying to, you know, diversify into global assets or investing overseas, we haven't seen that trend catching up.
Mm. One of the comments that, you know, in doing this research that really, really surprised me came from Pradeep Shah, where he said that the Indian central bank now views its job as protecting the purchasing power of currency. You know, which again sounds a bit weird here in New York. But I mean, is that your perception? Is that translating into action to really defend the rupee? And if so, is that action viewed as credible in the market?
So exchange rate has not been a major factor driving the monetary policy for several years, but I think there are There are periods when the bouts of volatility lead the exchange market, lead the central bank to take monetary action. Having said that, I think the stated objective over the years has been that they want to contain volatility and rather than protecting a certain level of the currency. The two things that have been, and the broader point is that I think the currency will be stable if your inflation is well behaved. Mm-hmm. And I think the new governor, Mr. Rajan, I think he's been very clear on two things. One is that the primary target has to be contain inflation, and not only the wholesale inflation, because that gets driven by global commodities, but the consumer inflation, which impacts every household. And second is India needs to rebuild savings. So the real rates have to stay positive for some time to induce savers to come back into financial assets, to come back into deposits. And that's why I think we need slightly higher rates. While the government and businesses have been clamoring for the lower interest rates to support growth, but I think he thinks that we need a balance between these objectives.
Gotcha. And, you know, I mean, switching over to sort of a debt outlook, I've heard some chatter about a downgrade, a debt downgrade for India, the country. My country got downgraded not too long ago. Is that something that, and everything seems to be very much the same. Is that something that seems likely, plausible, overblown? What are your feelings on that?
Two aspects. One is that the actual event of India getting downgraded to a junk status, I think, is very, very remote. I think the macro fundamentals are reasonably strong, and they don't justify that India should be into junk category. If you look at the public debt to GDP, if you look at the, there are hardly any implicit liabilities of the government, unlike most of the other parts of the world where there are very little pension liabilities or Medicare liabilities that the government has. And also, I think given the demographics, the growth potential, the overall strength of the financial sector, I think very low leverage among the household balance sheets are very strong. I think the by and large corporate balance sheets are reasonably in decent shape. So I think India getting downgraded to junk is very, very, very remote, I would say. Having said that, I think the one good thing that has happened because of the threat of the downgrade has done a lot of good to the country in a sense that the central government, despite this being an election year, I think has been behaving very sensibly on the fiscal side, because they know that the sword of downgrade is hanging on us, and because of that, the fiscal deficit has been under control. The serious reforms to consolidate the fiscal side, the budget deficit, began a year back, and I think some part would have been played by the threat of the sovereign rating downgrade of India. So, and then also a lot of reforms are taking place in the financial sector, and also the government has taken a lot of steps to revive growth and contain deficit. I think that's a good aspect of this threat. But the actual event, I'll be highly surprised. I'll be shocked, I mean, if S&P takes a step and says that India doesn't deserve a sovereign, India doesn't deserve an investment grade. One more aspect that people neglect is that the bulk of the Indian government's borrowing is in the domestic market. I mean, they have borrowed from the domestic banks and the households, and then they have not borrowed overseas. So I think that way the vulnerability of India defaulting to global investors is hardly there. So I'll be very surprised if that event takes place. I think that's a little overblown in that sense.
Well, that is certainly probably refreshing news to many investors. Navneet, thank you so much for joining us. This is Inside Investing. For more special report on India coverage, please go to insideinvesting.org.